Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm going to start today by asking a question that an awful lot of people in markets are indeed asking. One of the best market commentators out there, in fact, I don't know how he does his daily email. I thoroughly recommend it to any of our listeners. It's free from Bloomberg. It's a chap called John Authors. He was with the FT for a long time, and he writes the most amazing stuff every single day. I'm extremely envious. But he wrote today or yesterday, it's impossible to have any conversation about financial markets without being asked whether a bubble is inflating. And the reason why that question is being asked for those people that don't read the business pages, that don't pay too much attention to what's happening in stock markets, is that stock prices, equity markets everywhere, are either at or exceeding all-time highs. Now, that's the overall market. Obviously, that's not every share price, but an awful lot of shares are going up a lot. And some people are saying this feels very like the period at the end of the last century, 1999 going into 2000, when the markets spectacularly peaked in March 2000 and then fell precipitately, really for about 3 years. They kept going down with some ups in the middle. And that was an internet bubble. And the first thing to say about the current bubble spotters is that there are similarities, there are resonances with that time, in that it's technology again. Last time it was the internet. This time it's artificial intelligence. So we could talk about this all day, Jim, as I'm sure you know. And I just want to run through very briefly why people are saying what they're saying about this, and also to let people know what we think. I begin my research by actually asking one of the drivers of the current frothy stock market, artificial intelligence, what actually does it think a bubble is? And this is what Microsoft's Copilot, their version of ChatGPT, says. A stock market bubble is characterized by a significant rapid escalation in asset prices, far beyond what the fundamental value would suggest. Here are the key characteristics of a stock market bubble. Displacement. This occurs when investors get enamored with a new paradigm. Tick. We've certainly got that this time. That's artificial intelligence, hence why I'm asking AI what it thinks. Boom is the second feature. Prices start to rise at first slowly, but then gain momentum as more and more participants enter the market. That's a soft tick. I'm not quite sure that this is well defined. I'm not quite sure what we mean by slowly and then gain momentum in terms of precise measurement, but it certainly kind of sort of feels this way. Third element, euphoria. During this phase, asset prices skyrocket and there's widespread media coverage. Caution is thrown to the wind as more investors jump in, fearing they might miss out. I don't know whether we give this a tick or not, actually. There is certainly lots of media coverage. I've just mentioned John Authors from Bloomberg, and there are lots of other articles I could cite in the FT and Economist. The Economist, for example, certainly thinks it's a bubble. But I would caution there that The Economist always thinks when any asset price goes up that it's a bubble. It's a very pessimistic publication. So I don't know whether we've got euphoria yet. You can see elements of it. You can see why some people might argue we've got some, but it's not a slam dunk. The fourth element is profit-taking. And this is the beginning of the end of the bubble. And there's a clue here that I'll come back to. Some investors start to realize that prices can't go up forever and start to take profits. We haven't seen any evidence of that yet. And the final element is panic. As people rush for the exit, they realize that they can't get out because everybody's trying to do the same and prices collapse. And it's those last two elements that I think are very revealing about bubbles. Because obviously you don't know whether they're present until they've actually happened, whether people are panicking, and there's no evidence of that yet. So in many ways, being able to identify a bubble is only ever, we're only ever able to do it in the rear view mirror. And we're certainly not in the panic or even the profit taking stage yet. That could change instantly. There are lots of different ways in which you could say this is a bubble. Publications like The Economist point to the fact that it's been led by seven stocks in the United States. That's mostly true. The magnificent seven, the usual technology names led by companies like Nvidia that make the chips for AI, their valuations are on a par with some of the valuation norms that we saw back in March 2000. And it does seem that even Nvidia valuation has run ahead of any kind of fundamental assessment of where it's going. The trouble with that word fundamental is that everybody disagrees about what the fundamentals actually are. If we didn't have that disagreement, we wouldn't have people exchanging shares every day because people disagree about what the fundamentals are. Fundamentals for any company investment, of course, are the profits it's likely to earn in the future. And the second big driver of that is interest rates and bond yields for all sorts of reasons. And we talk about interest rates and bond yields all the time, and people know about that stuff if they've been listening to our podcast. So it's all very messy. I am encouraged, as somebody that has money in the stock market via my pension savings, that The Economist thinks it's a bubble, because I think The Economist is a great newspaper, but always gets its forecasts wrong. I think it's a great contrary indicator. That's slightly whimsical, of course. My overall assessment, drawn on many years of thinking about this kind of stuff, is that markets are very frothy. If I was a trader, I'd take some money off the table, but I'm not. I'm an investor, and so therefore I'm in it for the long haul, even though I'm old. So I could see the markets pulling back today, tomorrow, next week, next month, no idea when, but I do not see it as a bubble. Jim, as you know, we could talk about all or any of that in great detail for hours, and I know a lot of people would find it interesting, some people would find it very dull, so I'm not going to do it today. I might pick up on certain elements of that in future podcasts in terms of things like what are the fundamentals of investing, what are good principles for people saving for their old age, but I'm going to park that and ask you, first of all, have I left anything important out? Secondly, do you think it's a bubble?
If you saw the Japanese Nikkei there recently surpassed the peak that was seen back in 1989, when that Japanese Nikkei bubble burst back in 1989, you know, we got over 30 years of underperformance basically from that market. So that really was, I think, a very significant point for equity markets with the Nikkei back over the 1989 levels. But if you look at the factors that have been driving the equity market performance, you know, historically low interest rates, quantitative easing, the US economy certainly has defied expectations on the upside. Corporate profitability generally is growing. There is the whole phenomenon of AI and the role that Nvidia is having in the market. So, and there's lots of good reasons as to why the markets have done what they've done. And of course, you mentioned the Magnificent Seven, and you draw comparisons with the sorts of valuations we saw back in the early 2000s when the dot-com bubble burst. There is one fundamental difference here, I think. Companies like Nvidia are actually making something. You know, they're making chips for AI, phenomenal demand. And the expectation, of course, would be that other chip manufacturers like AMD or Intel will you know, increasingly ramp up in that market and take on the dominant position that NVIDIA has actually attained. But the point is that these companies are actually making something, in marked contrast to the dot-com bubble, when, you know, companies that never did and never would make a profit had massive valuations. So that really was bubble stuff. So I have mixed views on it, Chris. I mean, profits are still growing quite strongly. The economic outlook over the next couple of years actually looks a little bit better than we might have thought this time last year. So I'd be reasonably optimistic about the global economic backdrop. Interest rates are coming down. It's just a question of when rather than whether. And I think
I challenge you on that, Jim.
You can.
You know, you're going to tell us in a minute, I know, about the US inflation data yesterday. But the challenge is, on the back of that and other inflation and other data from the United States, you mentioned yourself there, the strong economy. What about the possibility that interest rates do not come down this year in the United States?
Well, if interest rates don't come down, you know, that will come as a massive disappointment for the markets. And we've seen from day to day a lot of market volatility being driven by interest rate expectations that are flipping on the basis of one economic data release. So there is a lot of choppiness. But undoubtedly, if the view grew over the next 2 or 3 months that interest rates in the United States were not coming down in the second half of this year, that certainly would be a disappointment for market performance. I think there's no doubt about that. But I actually think US rates will come down later this year. I think you'd be less certain on that than I would. And, you know, time will tell. Those are all of, I guess, the factors as to why equity markets do look okay, although frothy, as you say. But then you look at the other side of the balance sheet, the corporation tax burden is rising. You know, we have the minimum corporation tax rate of 15%. So the low corporation tax rates that have characterized recent years in most markets is certainly ending, not dramatically, but it is moving the other direction. There is obviously a danger that the euphoria around AI will actually disappoint and that there's an overemphasis on what AI will deliver. There is the concentration risk issue that you've mentioned, you know, in Europe and indeed in the United States. Certainly a small number of stocks have been very, very instrumental. And of course, the other point is that while I think interest rates are coming down, I don't believe we're going back to the sorts of interest rate levels that we've lived with in recent years. So in other words, interest rates are coming down, but I think over the next 5 years, average interest rates will be higher than over the past 5 years. So perhaps that's another factor. So, you know, you can make the argument actually both ways. And the reality is that none of us have a clue. All we can say is that the markets are at very high levels. There is froth in the markets. The momentum is still very much in an upward direction. That will change at some stage. I have no idea when. So if I was an equity investor, and this goes back to stuff you mentioned there about, you know, the principles of investment. I mean, I think the time horizon here is very important. If I had a very short term time horizon, I'd possibly be looking at taking profits in the near term. But if I had a long term perspective, I'd probably sit tight.
Yeah, those are, I think, good rules of thumb, to which there are departures from time to time,
yes,
but they are very rare. And I think that what you just said there has the virtue, at least, of complete intellectual honesty. It's not just you that doesn't have a clue, Jim. I would assert it's pretty much everybody else. And to the extent that you do have a clue, you're probably an astrophysicist with a data set that nobody else has access to. Knowledge of the latest mathematical techniques, operating a hedge fund that is closed to outside investors anyway, and just trading your own money and making yourself even more millions. Those are the sort of people that consistently make money from a trading perspective in markets. The rest of us mere mortals, I think, need to focus very much on something you said there about the time period, because the lesson of investing history is that time is your friend, in that if you can be patient and wait, the markets will reward you. But what people, and I think most people kind of sort of know that, but what they don't appreciate is just how long that wait can be. You mentioned Japan being decades. The UK's FTSE hasn't really gone anywhere this century, for example. You've got a good dividend yield from the FTSE 100, but you haven't had any capital appreciation to speak of at all. So it's horses for courses. The best equity market in the world historically, really since the beginning of data, is the United States, and that remains true in 2024. So some things do appear to be constant, but history isn't necessarily a good guide to the future, as all of the marketing literature says. So I conclude that my investing principles, like yours, Jim, remain unchanged, worried that markets are looking a little overstretched right now. But yes, there are fundamental differences between now and March 2000. There are some similarities as well, but enough differences to make me relatively relaxed for a long-term investor, for a pension saver, if you like. One of the things that encourages me, actually, and again, you could argue this both ways. I want you to tell us, if you don't mind, about yesterday's inflation data from the States. But before you do, I just want to state that the equity market just ignored it in a way that it hasn't done for ages. It was slightly disappointing inflation data, and yet the equity market soared, which tells me that the whole inflation interest rate outlook really isn't as important as it was, which is something that we've been banging on about for a little while. So tell us, Jim, what happened to that inflation number in the States?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Yeah, the headline inflation number in the States disappointed a little bit. And the markets had been expecting an unchanged headline rate of 3.1%. It came in at 3.2%. And the core rate fell from three, that's excluding food and energy prices. It was expected to decline from 3.9% in January to 3.7%. It came in at 3.8%, so slightly higher than the markets had been expecting. I saw headlines in some of the financial press online overnight leading with the disappointing US inflation data. And that the, you know, the last mile for the Federal Reserve is proving quite difficult. As you say, the markets have very little reaction to that. I think the markets have pretty much my view of the world at the moment, Chris, and that is that, you know, inflation will come down in a choppy way, but it will come down, and that interest rates in the United States will fall in the second half of the year, that the Federal Reserve will eventually move. And that European rates actually will move sooner than that. So no major market reaction. In the United Kingdom this morning, we saw in January, the short-lived and very mild recession in the United Kingdom ended. January GDP was up by 0.2%.
Wow.
Well, come on now, Chris. Come on. That was stronger than market expectations, and it certainly defies all of the negativity around the UK economy.
Well, 0.2%.
Come on, it's actually performing a little bit better than people like you have been predicting for the last...
Could that number be revised away within a few weeks?
It could, or it could be revised up. Mm. And indeed, February could actually turn out a little bit stronger.
In fairness, I think the mood music around the UK has shifted a little, and it is a little bit more positive. There are signs that things are getting better.
Mm. No, I think it is, absolutely.
Can I just throw in a quick aside there? One of the things that's emerging in the UK as a big problem, potentially a big problem, is the economic inactivity rate, the number of people between the age of 18 and 64 who are not in education and not available for work, not in work, and the proportion of those who are actually out of work, out of the labour force because they're sick. That number, last number in particular, is going up all the time, and it's a real concern because it is actually one of the headwinds for growth, in that if you haven't got the workers, you're not going to get anybody producing anything unless you're doing it only with machines, which of course is possible these days. But there is a short, you know, despite the fact the UK economy doesn't grow, it's up 0.2, down 0.2. We've always said that, Jim, both you and I have agreed on that. It's flatlining. And even if the mood music is improving, it's not going to improve that much unless you can get some workers from somewhere. But it seems that too many of them, for all sorts of reasons, are out of work and also on the sick. Now, of course, that raises the question, why are they on the sick? And I'm not going to get into that today. That's a subject for another podcast. But there are two very distinct schools of thought on this, and I'm sure you know what they are. One is, from the right of the political spectrum, they're all swinging the lead, they're all malingerers, they're all pretending to have back pain and depression. And on the left of the political spectrum, there is a view that they are all genuinely sick. The truth probably lies somewhere in the middle, but we'll get into that at another time. But the lack of workers is a real UK growth problem.
The Central Bank of Ireland published its quarterly economic outlook earlier this week. Just to take you through the headlines from that, one is that between 2024 and 2026, the central bank is predicting that compensation per employee will grow by 2.9% per annum in real terms. So in other words, wage growth is going to outpace inflation. And we're going to see for the first time in a while, I think, you know, strong real growth in incomes. And the two key reasons underlying that prediction from the central bank is, number one, inflation is going to prove lower than expected. And secondly, labour markets are going to remain very, very tight. And in that context, the unemployment rate is forecast at 4.6% this year on average. It's at 4.2% at the moment. And they're talking about average of 4.5% in 25 and 26. So in other words, the labour market here expected to remain strong and tight. Inflation is expected to average 2% this year, 1.8% in 2025, and 1.4% in 2026. Although they do point out that most of that low inflation will be driven by goods prices, whereas the service sector prices are still remaining quite sticky. And that indeed is a story everywhere. Modified domestic demand, which is stripping out the nebulous stuff from GDP, and as we've often spoken about, is a more accurate measure of what's happening on the ground in the real economy. It grew by 0.5% according to the CSO last year. This year, it's expected to grow by 2%, 1.9% next year, 2% the following year. As well as I do, just how meaningless it is to come out with these very precise forecasts. But what the central bank is suggesting actually is that the, you know, economy will remain reasonably steady over the next couple of years. They're forecasting that new home completions will reach 37,000 by 2026. Last year, we delivered just over 32,000. So gradual move in the right direction in terms of housing delivery. And one of the reasons for their relative optimism on housing, because we've often spoken about one of the big constraints is labour supply. But the central bank is looking at what's happening in terms of commercial activity, which is weakening. And they reckon there will be a transfer of labour from commercial construction activity over to the residential side. And just the final piece, they're looking at, you know, what are the risks to this forecast? One is, you know, global headwinds. Secondly, is capacity constraints, particularly in the labor market. They're talking about the new trading rules relating to Brexit that have been implemented in the UK are starting to have more of a negative impact on Irish exporters to the UK and imports indeed from the UK. They are talking about labour supply shortages, particularly in the public sector, in financial services and professional services. And finally, they're talking about a trend that's becoming more obvious, and that is there is a decline in the average hours worked per employee. In a fully employed economy, I think that is interesting. I get the overall sense that since COVID, people have actually refocused their lives a little bit, and leisure time is now seen as being more important.
Yeah, I know that you talk a lot, quite rightly, about the headwinds facing in particular SMEs, particularly hospitality and retail. And I just wanted to add an anecdote to the pressures that I know that you say those industries are under, particularly from the cost side, particularly from the regulation side, and workers, getting workers at a reasonable rate is one of the headwinds that they face. The cost of labour is going up, and you've just cited one of the reasons there, but there's a shortage of workers generally, and it's becoming more expensive to be an SME in the hospitality space in particular. I've had the privilege over the last week of spending time in Dublin, London and Paris, and although this is pure anecdote, it's not data. Obviously, I have not eaten and drunk in all of the establishments of all of those three cities, though at times it just felt like that. My big surprise is that compared to London and Dublin, Paris is now cheap.
Wow.
And that's new for me.
Yeah, that is certainly new. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Dublin has become an incredibly expensive city, and London is expensive. And I remember the first time I visited Paris, thought it was incredibly expensive relative to Ireland. So very, very definitely there is a flip occurring there, which is interesting. I have to say, you know, we did have a very enjoyable dining experience in a Japanese restaurant in Dublin last week.
We did. That was great fun.
The sushi was nice.
Indeed.
Far from sushi, I was brought up, Chris. But anyway... there are a few political events that I just want to mention. We had two referenda in Ireland on changes to the constitution last week. One related to the status of family and the mother. The second related to the status of caregivers. There was a 44.4% turnout. The opinion polls a few weeks ago were predicting a strong yes vote and both referenda. In the event, the family referendum was defeated by 67.7% to 32.3%, and the care referendum was defeated by 73.9% to 26.1%. So the government side and, you know, the Green Party, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil were pushing for a yes vote very strongly. Sinn Féin were pushing for a yes vote. People Before Profit were pushing for a yes vote, the Labour Party, the Social Democrats. So there was a real two fingers given to the political establishment in this country last weekend. And it is fascinating to hear those on the government side, particularly, you know, talking about why this happened. They're describing the far right as having an impact there. They're describing people as being uninformed, etc., etc. Pretty condescending and insulting stuff. I went up to vote last Friday evening and I met 10 people. This isn't a representative sample, but everybody I spoke to were saying, oh, we're voting no on both because we don't like the wording. We don't believe what government is telling us. We believe that it actually will represent a deterioration in the real situation for the mother and also for caregivers. So that's a pretty simplified explanation, I guess. But it is amazing to see the government reaction to this. And I think a lot of people just are getting sick of the wokeism that is becoming increasingly prevalent in this country. And nobody like the Irish electorate to actually turn around and give two fingers to the system when the need arises. I could be totally wrong on that, but that's certainly the sense I get. And I think the Taoiseach, particularly in the agenda he's been driving, you know, is pissing a lot of people off, quite frankly. So it was certainly an interesting wake-up call and a total political failure on behalf of the main political parties. Whether this has any implications for the local European and general election, which are coming up in the next 12 months, remains to be seen. But politically, it was a pretty cataclysmic weekend in this country.
Yeah, the political establishment needs to be very careful about how it responds to these sorts of things, because we've seen elsewhere and here in Britain in terms of the Brexit referendum, the moment an electorate starts thinking it's being condescended to or patronised, it will bite you very, very hard. And people quite naturally, quite understandably, quite rightly, don't like that. And if this coalition government, along with all the other political parties, by the sound of things, Jim, are condescending to the electorate, then I think that actually has potential ramifications for the general election, because that means people will change their minds about who they're going to vote for, and the opinion polls become meaningless, actually. So they need to be very, very careful.
Yeah, I actually think one of the big losers here was, in terms of opportunity cost, was Sinn Féin, because they were critical about the wording, but yet they pushed for a yes vote. I think if Sinn Féin had actually come out strongly, we don't like the wording, we are advocating a no vote, I think the political kudos that the party would have gained from that would have been absolutely massive. And, you know, so I would see it for Sinn Féin as an opportunity missed. We had a general election in Portugal at the weekend. António Costa had been in power since 2015, leader of a socialist government of sorts. He left office, resigned last November amidst a scandal of which he didn't appear to have anything to do with really, but he deemed it necessary to actually step down. And the centre-right Democratic Alliance won the election very narrowly. They gained 79 seats out of 230, so they will hold the balance of power by a very narrow margin. But I think the really interesting piece was that the far-right party, CHEGA, C-H-E-G-A, it won 18.1% of the vote. It gained 48 seats, up from 12 before the election. So even in a country like Portugal that actually is doing pretty well in relative terms at the moment, we see the far right. The other political event that I know you will have a lot to say on, and I think we're up against time now, but the move of Lee Anderson, the former deputy chairman of the Tory party, over to join the Reform Party, giving the Reform Party the first MP in the parliament. So that just shows how toxic politics is at the moment within the Tory party.
Absolutely, Jim. The 30p Lee, as he's called, because the reference to how much he thinks people need to live on each day, that's his third political party. He began life in Labour, has ended up on the far right, a journey you and I have remarked on many different times about the horseshoe theory of politics. Some people travel along the horseshoe and end up roughly where they started, but with a different label. It shows you the trouble that the Tory party is in. We'll talk about that. I think we'll talk about that at greater length in another podcast, because the really interesting question is where it will go once it loses, presumably, the next general election badly. Will One Nation Toryism reassert itself, or will they splinter and coalesce around a much more extreme far-right party? And I think that's the really, really interesting question, which I think we'll leave for another day. And there's another thing for another day, because I think there's been some really interesting developments behind the scenes almost with respect to Donald Trump's relationship with TikTok. But I'll leave that as a teaser for next time.
Excellent. Good to talk, Chris.
All the best, mate.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.